I've entitled it Worldwide Partnership, which is nothing special in itself, I suppose, but I want to give a lot of examples here that maybe we don't normally speak about. Before we do that, one verse from Revelation chapter 3, verse 9. This is where the Jews had become upset that so many of the people in the church were Gentiles. They didn't consider them to be proper followers of God. The risen Christ says to these Jews, or concerning these Jews, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, I will make them come and bow down before your feet and learn that I have loved you. And that is what I believe God has got to do with many of us in the Western world today. He's got to make us realize that we have lost the plot, that we are sick, that we might come and bow down, so to speak, before the feet of our brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia and Latin America, and realize that they are the ones who are providing the leadership and the growth and the vigor and the dynamism in the church today. We have to come and repent and change our ways. I'm going to speak a bit negatively to begin with and then go into something more positive as we move on. But it's necessary to be negative because, as Jesus said, if you don't realize you're sick, you won't go to the doctor. And that's the problem with many of us in the Western world. We say we have this and that, and as the Lord of the Church says in another one of these letters in Revelation, you don't realize that you are in fact wretched and pitiable and poor and blind and naked. And that is the spiritual state of many of the churches in our country and comparable countries of the West. What is needed first is that we must admit our spiritual sickness. And I'm going to give you a number of illustrations, and they're not very flattering for us. As I travel around, the single factor that I notice where we are most different from the rest of the world is in prayer. The only way you can get people here to pray sometimes is to get them to a prayer breakfast or have some meal that goes with it. It's interesting, isn't it? A prayer breakfast. The word breakfast means break your fast. In the Bible, sometimes it talks about praying and fasting. The only way we can get people to pray is if you break your fast. So if you put on prayer breakfast, they might come because they're going to eat at the same time. But the Christians in these other countries are committed to prayer. I had this driven home to me a few years ago at a prayer congress. It was a weekend of prayer at Tambourine Mountain. There were several hundred people there, 450 I think over the weekend, a lot of them from Australia. But a great contingent came also from Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, I think around about 100 and something from those two countries. People had saved up and got themselves the minimum couple hundred dollars they needed to make the trip, and it was a special event for them. Few people from the Solomons there that I knew, and because this was their first time to Australia, I thought, well, on the Sunday afternoon when there's a free spot, I will take them for a little bit of a drive around the mountain, show them some of the sights. So I saw them on the first night and we agreed to it. But after lunch on the Saturday, I saw one of them again, happened to bump into him, and he said, look, I'm sorry, we'll have to cancel that sightseeing excursion tomorrow afternoon, because by this time it had become evident that the neediest country of the South Pacific, this was a South Pacific prayer convention, the neediest country in the Pacific region was Australia. And these Solomon Islander people, they had decided that they were going to spend the weekend in prayer and fasting for Australia. Now they'd already paid for their accommodation and meals, and they weren't even going to get their money's worth out of the meals because they were going to fast instead. But the point of the illustration comes on the Sunday evening. One of the Australian groups in their house party, a group connected with one of the missions, had gone off for a meeting, and they came back late for the meal, about 25 minutes. Everybody waited for them, and some of the others in the group were really angry, and there's a rather unpleasant atmosphere. So one of the people responsible for the late arrival of this group, he got up in the evening service, and he apologized for creating this unhappy spirit through being late and being ill-considerate of others. I felt like crawling under the seat. They didn't know that here are these people from a poor country, the Solomon Islands, who've actually blown their money and what they paid for the camp, and they're fasting for Australia because we're spiritually sick. And here are the Australians having a fight because they didn't get their meal on time. It really underlines the problem that we have. Ray Laird, who was tied up with one of the missions up in the Solomon Islands, he said that he'd interviewing somebody who wanted to go up there as a missionary, and when Ray quizzed this person about his commitment to prayer, the fellow said, well, I'm not really big on prayer. Ray said, fancy ever sending somebody to the Solomon Islands who was a bit sick on prayer. I've had two cases where I've been in countries. One was in Nepal, the other was in Nigeria, where I've been lecturing in a Bible school, and they've come to me, the organizers, and said, tomorrow we're arranging for somebody to bring the midday meal to you because tomorrow is our day of prayer and fasting. And I felt a bit embarrassed. Here am I up there lecturing to these students. They're fasting and I've got to have a meal. Oh, come on. I said, look, if that's what you're doing, that's what I'll do. That was a once a week thing that they were doing. Once a week they had this day of prayer and fasting in the interests of world mission. By contrast, I was in UK a few years ago at a special meeting that was arranged over a weekend for about 70 potential missionaries. I wasn't one of the speakers. I just happened to go along because I heard about this thing and they said you might appreciate it. After one of the morning sessions, we broke into groups of five or six to pray. So I attached myself to one of these groups and I waited and waited and waited for somebody to pray. Nobody did, so in the end I prayed. And then I waited again and still nobody did, so I prayed a second time. And then after a while that was the end of the prayer time. The room was very quiet. There were these 10 or 15 groups of people that were praying, but it was very quiet. Some of these countries you go to, when they all pray, it's so noisy you can't hear anything. And I observed in one other group, there was one fellow that I happened to know who prayed twice, and there didn't seem to be a lot of activity. And I thought, these are people that are supposed to be missionaries. What's the point of sending these people to some of these countries? And they don't even know how to pray. If there's one thing these people do in these other countries, it's they pray. I kept my thoughts to myself, but later in the day I happened to bump into somebody else, and so the conversation drifted on and I mentioned my observations in the morning. He said it was the same in my group. You just couldn't get them to pray. There's something radically wrong when we can't pray. An Ethiopian couple up in Bundaberg that I know, I was just chit-chatting with them one day and how they miss their country and all that sort of thing. And she said, the thing I miss most is the prayer. She said, the people here, they're nice Christians and they're friendly, but they don't know how to pray. Well, I could give other examples. Let's move on to the second one, a spiritual void. Now, I've had people from other countries that have moved through and I've asked them what they thought of Australia. And they try to be polite. And I said, don't try to be polite, just tell me the truth. One of them, he was from Romania. He just said, well, in one word, superficial. Their Christianity is just stuck on the outside of their ordinary lives. Man from the Philippines, he started to say nice things. And I said, oh, come on, Nilo, just tell me the truth. He said, you want to know the truth? He said, I wept. I wept to think that here was a country that had so much going for it, and the Christianity was so shallow, so pathetic. A friend of mine from Italy, he said he could not believe that there could be so many Italians in Australia and virtually none of them in any of the churches he visited. He said, what's the church been doing? He said there were hardly anybody other than Anglo-Saxon Christians in any of the churches that he went to. There's a weakness in our spirituality that needs to be addressed. The third thing, giving. If you look at Operation World, you'll read something there that is frightfully embarrassing. Here it is for all the world to see, the handbook of world mission that everybody should have. And concerning Australia, it says, the giving of Christians to world mission is worse in Australia than any other country in the developed world. You contrast this with Singapore. I just get my mind blown when I go there and hear the amounts that they give. When I oohed and aahed on one occasion, one of the Singaporeans said to me, he said, are you Australians? He said, you don't know anything about giving. One day I was just here locally waiting for my hair to get cut, picked up a Newsweek magazine that was lying there, and I started to read through it, and it had a survey of how countries of the English-speaking Western world respond to appeals for money. I can't give you how they worked out the index, it's just the relationship of the figures that matters. United States had a figure of about 530. United Kingdom, England, Great Britain if you wish, had a figure of about 450, and Canada was much the same. New Zealand was round about 300, and Australia was round about 180. And there we were again, so far behind the rest. If you talk to people in mission organisations, they will say how difficult it is to raise money. In Australia Missionary Tidings, they ran appeals on behalf of the tidal wave victims in New Guinea, the victims of the earthquake in Colombia. They got a good response, but they said all our other income disappeared. People didn't give anything extra, they just shifted from one to the other, and so our general fund suffered, and they said we're no longer able to run those sorts of appeals. Last week on the news, you may have heard it yourself, there was a complaint, well it wasn't a complaint, it was a comment of a report prepared by the government, where it said that organ donations, you know, donations of organs in your body, eyes, heart, liver or lungs, whatever you want to donate, was the lowest in Australia of any country in the Western world. We've got a real problem in this country. It's a national problem of self-indulgence, greed, satisfaction, and not very much in the way of self-sacrifice. The fourth thing I've got here, hospitality. As for being hospitable to those who they don't know, they very often are not even hospitable to those they do know. Among Christians it's almost disappeared, even though it's supposed to be mainly exercised among non-Christians. But when I go to these countries, I go to Botswana, I go to Nepal, to Uganda, Eastern European countries, without exception, the people are in poor circumstances, and yet they'll invite you home for a meal. You've never seen these people before. They'll ask you to stay with them, and I say, look, just put me up at a guest house, put me up anywhere, I don't want to be a burden. No, 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 no. They want you to come and stay with them. And you look at their circumstances, and you realize how your visit must be straining the family budget. Hospitality, it's one of the signs of real Christianity, and it's very lacking in our country. A number of years ago, Gay and I were away for about 4 months. We'd had quite a ministry in Eastern Europe. We'd been in parts of Africa. We were sitting at Johannesburg Airport. Gay was to get the plane home, and I was to go on further ministry by myself into Namibia and Botswana. And I just said to Gay, if you get home and somebody says, what was the highlight of the trip? What would you say? We'd been to about 14 countries. She thought for a while, and she said, I would say the hospitality we enjoyed in the homes of the countries in Eastern Europe, in the homes of the Christians, rather, in Eastern Europe. I said, that's exactly what I would say. Without exception, poor, difficult conditions, cramped, none of the mod cons that we all take for granted. But the hospitality we enjoyed there was so precious. But it's disappeared from our Christian scene. The fifth point I want to make is our lack of vision for the world. Now, I go to a clapped-out country like Nigeria. My mental picture is that in every church I went, there was a map on the wall. Every Bible school, there was a map on the wall. And there were targets. They have a bigger vision for the world than we have, praying for countries all over the world. Up in the Solomon Islands, I met a man. There was a map on his wall. He had blue and red pins at different places. And I said, what's all this? He said, I'm praying for people in this country. When I get an answer to prayer, I put the other colour in. And here it was all over the world. Amazing to find in the most unexpected places a knowledge of the world that we seem to be lacking here. But not only lacking the knowledge, lacking even the interest. Once again, I was in a congress in the United Kingdom some years ago. There were about 300 from England, and then there were about 40 of us from other countries. I was one of only two or three from the Western world. There were about 30-something from various other countries of Africa, Asia, a couple from Latin America, and some from Eastern Europe. We went through the normal sessions each day. One afternoon, there was a free time, and electives were made available. And they said, you don't have to go to these, but there are two offering. One of them was on Yugoslavia. So I went along to that one, and of the 350 people there, only about 23 were at this elective, and I found that the same number were at the alternative. What the other people were doing, I don't know. But of the 23 that were there, the only Europeans were all people like myself who had some connection with Yugoslavia. We'd either been there or we were from a church that was involved in some ministry there. But out of this small number of Africans and Asians at the conference, they made up over half the audience. We drew the Europeans out of over 300, and we could only get a dozen. We were drawing the Afro-Asians out of only about 30, and we still managed to get 12 or whatever the number was. There were more of them anyway than there were of us. Their appetite for finding out what is the church doing, it's a real challenge. And the final point I've got here, we must admit our spiritual sickness. That's what I'm saying, I'm being a bit negative, sorry about that, don't all go home yet. But we've got to see that we are sick. Otherwise, we won't go to the doctor to get the healing. We're sick in prayer. We're sick with this spiritual apathy. We're sick in relation to giving. We're sick in relation to hospitality. We're poor again in our world vision. And finally, even the sending out of missionaries. Now, I know the world has changed. We have to think seriously about our role in sending out foreign missionaries to other countries. But these other countries, they now have such a big vision. Our problem is that we think we're going to send somebody somewhere and they're going to tell them all how to do it. One of the Eastern European countries I was in just recently, one of the fellows told me, he said, after freedom came, we had these people came from America and they were going to run these Bible schools and they wanted me to go. They were going to tell us how to do it. And he said, when I went there, I said to this man, why are you asking me to go to this Bible school? Are you going to teach me or am I going to teach you? A little bit of a sting in the tail there, because this man, under communism, had been running a Bible college for 20 years, had been producing people that were leaders in churches. And in the fire of communism, in the persecution, in the difficulties, here we had a vigorous work going on. But of course, we from the West, we think we've got all the answers, and so now the Iron Curtain has come down, we're going to go in there and we're going to give them all our wisdom and tell them how to do it. That conference I referred to in the UK just a few moments ago, one man from Angola got up there And he said something that just about had everybody falling off their chairs. He said, please don't send any missionaries to Angola. Now, as he moved on, we found that his understanding of the word missionary was evangelist. Because he said, we do need Bible teachers. We need people who can teach our elders, who can teach in our Bible colleges. We need teachers. But as for the Sokotuam evangelist or the stand on the street corner preaching style of evangelist, these countries have people queued up wanting to be evangelists. They are just so fired up about evangelism, but they're in great need of teaching to disciple people and equip them in the Word of God. Another man called René Didanzo from the Chad, I was sharing a conference with him in Italy, and in the course of his talk he was saying how they can mobilize 3,000 people in evangelism, and his interpreter said 300. He questioned him. He said, no, 3,000. And then he moved on a bit further, and he gave some other statistic, and the interpreter queried him privately again. And he said, no, people cannot grasp. There are over 1,000 brethren assemblies alone in Chad, and that's in a population of only 6 million. Here we are in Australia, something approaching 20 million. We can only rustle up 200 to 250. They've got over 1,000. And the growth has spread right through the country. They strategize, they target areas. They move in if they find 75 villages where there is no church. They say, we're going to put a church there in the next 12 months. And then they mobilize people to go and do it. Oh, the vision for the world. That's the final heading I've got in those negatives. I've just got a note here that I cut out of the magazine. I'll read it to you. Because we from the West have this problem of thinking that we know it all. There may be a limited range of activities now that we can engage in overseas. It's not the open slather that it used to be 50 years ago in the old colonial era. But when we do go in, we've got to clip our own wings, so to speak. And we're not to be guilty of the sort of illustration I gave you a few moments ago when this man thought he's going to go in and tell everybody how to do it. This was from a group who'd been working in China. He said it was a challenge to hear our key contact Chinese say through an interpreter, the problem with many of those who come in from outside to teach is that they lack the abundant life. They have the knowledge in their heads, and we're grateful for that, but they appear to lack living faith in their hearts. Their prayer life lacks intensity. Their lifestyle denies the simple Christian lifestyle we see in Scripture. And their attitudes are often not Christ-like in the way they treat us and the students. And the students can tell. I can identify with what is being said there. I come home from some of these trips that I go on and I feel cut down to size. I feel like a pygmy. I go there to teach, and as this man says, we appreciate that. We want somebody to teach. And I can teach because I've got a body of knowledge that I can pass on. I can teach them the book of Isaiah or the book of Deuteronomy or Galatians or whatever it is. But I always come home having learnt more than I taught. And what has changed my life, tipped me upside down, so to speak, is what I've learned about the real things of Christianity, prayer and discipleship and commitment, faith. And so it goes on. Let me move on now to the more positive side. Partnership. Paul said to the people in Philippi, you were partners with me from the beginning. You shared in my missionary endeavors. You know the verse, I've tried to quote it from memory but haven't quite got it straight. Now I want to talk about how we can enter into partnership. This is another subject that maybe I can speak on in greater detail some other time. But I just want to clear the decks at present. I want to lay the foundation and say some of the things we need if we're going to have true partnership with our brothers and sisters in other countries. The first thing we need is humility. We've got to get rid of that arrogance that says we know it all. Those colonial attitudes that make us think that somehow we're better because the country operates better, more efficient, our social amenities are much better. Because of that, we think that our Christianity is better. We think that our churches are better, and they're not. And we need to realize that although we may know something about organizing a civilized society along Western economic principles, we know very little about following Jesus Christ as true disciples. We know little about the fervor of evangelism, love for the lost, and going out and doing it. We need to learn. Like those people in Revelation, we need to come and bow at their feet and say, look, I want to learn from you. And that's what we need. I said at one of these international conferences, when I had to give in a comment sheet at the end, I said, well, there were some good things happened here, but I said, next time you put on a conference like this, and you have 300 and something from the West, and 20 or 30 from Asia and Africa and so on, next time you have it, let them do the talking and we will sit back and listen. You see, they had invited these people because they thought these people will benefit from the conference. Well, I suppose they did. But if they had to let these people do the talking instead of all the whites, and we sat back and listened to them, then it might have shaken us and we might have learned something. We need to change our attitudes. We've got to get rid of this arrogance, this know-all approach, foster a greater humility. We need to realize that intelligence has nothing to do with lifestyle, and that is the great problem. I hear people laugh at people from other countries when they speak English in a quaint fashion, or when they do things that may not be the way we would do them, as if somehow that is wrong, as if somehow these people are immature, and it makes me boil when I see people behave like this. I've heard people cast aspersions because others are illiterate, not blaming them for their illiteracy, but making the assumption that because they're illiterate, they're a bit dumb, that they're not intelligent. Look, let me assure you that illiteracy has nothing whatever to do with intelligence. It has more to do with good luck, if you can put it crudely. We just happen to be lucky that we're living in a country where everybody is supposed to be literate because we're taught. Many people in countries of the world don't have those opportunities. I've known some illiterate people who are actually very intelligent. I know some literate people who are not very intelligent at all. We must not make literacy or style of dress or ability in communications in English. We must not make those things a touchstone whereby we measure other people's spiritual growth or maturity. Suppose we made linguistic ability a measure of intelligence. We of the English-speaking world would just about be the most unintelligent people on the globe. We would be the dumbest. Almost everybody on this planet can speak at least two languages, and many of them can speak a lot more. It's only the English-speaking countries where we are limited to one language. Our linguistic ability is pretty poor. Those countries, incidentally, are United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, and New Zealand. Only six countries in the world where English is the first language of the majority of people. And those six countries would be the most incompetent linguistically. And so if we make linguistic ability a test of intelligence, then we fare badly. It's got nothing to do with literacy or linguistic ability or anything. We've got to get rid of these attitudes. I had it emphasized again when this friend of mine, René Didanzo, I mentioned a moment ago, he was one of the speakers at another conference that I was at, and there were some fellows there from Papua New Guinea, or one, anyway, a Papua New Guinean man who is a representative of the Brethren Council that controls affairs in Papua New Guinea. And he asked me if I'd go up there for their, I think every 2 years they put on a big meeting, if I'd be their speaker for the week. And I said, look, I've been there before. You always seem to get Australians or Kiwis going up there. I said, why don't you get somebody from another country, from Asia, somewhere in Asia? And he said, well, I don't know anybody. So I gave him two or three names. And he said, oh, well, we'll think about it. Anyway, later on in the conference, this René Didanzo from the Chad, he gave an address. I just happened to see my friend from PNG in the course of the day, and he said, that's the man we're going to get to PNG. Wow, he said, wouldn't he be great? He said, he's African, he's black, he looks like us, he said, we come from the same ethnic stock. He said, he would be just the person to liven things up and bring something different. And I said, well, go for it. I happened to see that man about 6 months later, while I spoke to him on the phone, and I said, hey, how did you go about getting René Didanzo for your big conference? Oh, he said, it got scuttled. It got torpedoed by one missionary. Now, their council only had the one missionary on it. All the rest were PNGians. But this missionary happened to be at that same conference. And he had heard René speak, and he just said, I couldn't believe it. He said he was just mouthing off. And this PNG man said to me, he said, I think the real truth is, he couldn't hack it. He couldn't wear it. That here you have this man from Africa who has done this great work and who has been one of the motivators in the whole evangelization through country after country in West Africa. René Didanzo would be the best known Brethren person in the world, certainly the most influential and most powerful, because he's the associate director of the Associations of Evangelicals of Africa. Everybody in Africa knows the name René Didanzo. But here, of course, we don't know about those people because they're African. But I think this PNG man was right. This other white missionary simply couldn't wear it, that this African man was so far ahead that he just had to write it all off as hearsay. Anybody that lives in Africa, anybody will know that what René Didanzo is saying is correct. and we've got all the evidence of the growth right through that country, and it's spread into neighbouring countries as well. You see, that's the arrogance. But because the local P&G people were more gracious than the one European, they deferred to him, and so the man was not invited, which is a sad story. We've got to let the nationals set the agenda. We ask them what we can do. We don't tell them what we're going to do. We don't tell them what they should do. Another time I was at a conference where various things were talked about. They were discussing the mission organization and the need for cooperation between the mission organization at home and the commending church at home and the missionary we send out onto the field and the workers on the field who are going to receive this person. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a very poor presentation. My friend from Papua New Guinea was there. I thought at the end of this presentation I'm going to raise my hand and say I'd like this man over here to say something. But I didn't need to, because sitting right in front of me was a man from Pakistan, and he raised the very same issue. He said, you haven't said anything about the national church, and surely that is the most important thing we should be considering. You don't just sit in the West and say, hey, we're going to send this person to such and such a place in such and such a country. What an arrogant way to go about things when you've got a national church there that has already been established. We should be consulting them and asking them what they think, what they need, and then responding, not simply telling them what we're going to do to them. And sometimes the returning missionaries have not been a help. When I was in the Solomon Islands, I found it rather saddening to be in some places where the people, they were just crying out for RE material, religious education in schools, crying out for material. They said, we don't get any. And I said, what about the missionaries that used to be here? Don't they send anything up? And they said, no, we never hear from them. When they were here, they did this and that. They've gone home, we never hear from them. And I said, look, around Australia and New Zealand, there must be religious education material that's been used and it's just sitting there. Why can't it be recycled? And within a matter of weeks, Gay and I had rustled up a couple of cartons of used religious education material and pushed it up to these people in Solomon Islands. You think, what were these people doing? What is the mentality of these missionaries that they've done their work, they come home, and that's the end of it? There are just so many ways that we can help these people. Mind you, they're not all like that. I think of a man called Alan Wheeler, who used to be a missionary in Africa, and he's gone back, and what he has done to motivate people in Victoria, sponsoring Bible school students in Africa and doing other things to help the church, is highly commendable. So I don't want you to think that all the returning missionaries are useless. There's a case which is the complete opposite. And as I said, the mission agencies are not always a help, not through any fault of theirs, but it doesn't matter whether it's AMT or SIM or WEC or whoever it is, they are flat out getting enough funds to finance their own operations that they are not really geared, a lot of them, towards helping and partnering with the national church organizations. And that's where I'm saying that we need to establish some direct links or some network whereby we can get the stuff, the money, the books, the Bibles, the resources, whatever they are, out of this country into some of these places. I think we should be funding programs rather than pastors or evangelists. I'm not entirely convinced that it's a good idea for us here to be paying the wages of a pastor or an evangelist in another country. The local churches in those countries have got to realize that that is their responsibility, to support their own workers. But when it comes to the equipment, many times they simply don't have the equipment, or if they do have it, it costs the same in those countries as it costs here. In other words, if we have an income of, let us say, $1,000, in those countries the people only have an income of, let us say, $20. Now they've got to live, they can grow their own vegetables or have a few chickens, and they can just about survive. But you can see they've got no money. If you have to buy, let us say, a photocopier that's going to cost, we'll say, $1,000, we somehow can budget to do it here. But there's no way that those people are ever going to be able to budget to buy a photocopy. So what I'm saying is we don't have to provide the wages for the pastors and the evangelists, but we ought to be looking for ways of helping with some of these other resources. It could be sponsoring orphans through school, or sponsoring Bible college students, as I just mentioned, or a translation project, translating the Bible into XYZ language in the region, or translating some other Bible helps, or other material things that need money. They need money, and that's what the people don't have. They've got enthusiasm, they've got prayer, but they don't have money to buy paper or machinery or whatever it happens to be. I've written down a list here, off the top of my head, so to speak, of things that they need. And as I say, they're paying roughly the same there as we'd pay here, in spite of the great difference in our income levels. They're quite happy to put together their own building, more or less. They can build it out of local materials, and they can use their own labour. But the other things that are imported, the equipment, it's not only expensive, but the government puts a heavy tax on it, and so the prices are high. Here's my list: photocopiers, OHP, computers, printers for computers, a phone or fax, email facilities, generators, fans, paper, anything in the stationery line, school books, textbooks, Christian books, Bibles, bicycles. So we've got to somehow bring ourselves to thinking about how we can help these countries. Here's a quote that I took, you may have heard it before, from some book, where a man said, concerning his going to these countries and seeing how the church developed, he said, "We fish, then we taught them how to fish, and now they fish so much better than we ever did." And that is my observation. They are doing the work so much more effectively, but they are limited and they are in crisis, because the converts are coming too rapidly for comfort. And if these people are not discipled, if they don't get their roots down into the word, they are going to finish up being a new breed of nominal Christians, legalistic and spiritually dead. And in the end, you'll have a worse problem than you had at the beginning. This is the problem, of course, in some of the Pacific Island nations, some of the Caribbean nations, that have been Christianized to the point where now you can't do anything with anybody and the church is largely dormant. Some of these countries in Asia and Africa, which are coming into this new spiritual life, it is so important that we get these resources to the pastors and teachers, because they're struggling to get their work done. They simply do not have the material. I was at a Bible college in one country, in a little office. It was about 1.5 meters square. The two of us fitted in, and that was about all. There were just 3 or 4 books on his shelf, and I thought, I wonder if this is all the material a man has. One of them was the Lion Handbook of the Bible and a couple of other smaller things. So I asked a discreet question. I said, where do you do your study preparation for your lectures? Do you do it at home? Oh, he said, I can't do it at home. He said, there's my wife, myself, 2 children and my mother. We all only live in one room. And he said, there's no room there. No, he said, I have to do it all here. He gave me the answer I wanted. That was his library. And here he is with a Bible school of students, and he's trying to teach them. And all of these people want to go out and to evangelize and plant churches and pastor churches. But if they don't have the substance there, then we are going to finish up with a stereotype form of Christianity, which is going to be damaging in the long run. Christo-paganism, it's called, where people slap a veneer of Christianity on the outside of former pagan ideas. And before we criticize that, let me assure you that the problem we have in Australia is Christo-secularism, where people simply slap a veneer of Christianity around their basic secularism. And that is our problem. The difference is that the people in Africa are aware of it, but we at home are not aware of it. We just sail blithely on. Let me conclude by pointing the way forward. Partnering together, striving together for the faith of the gospel, as the apostles said. What I'm going to suggest to you is that you can think about this in your local churches. I've got 5 little points here. We need in our church someone who could be an international facilitator and also a local enthusiast. It could be the same person, it could be several people, but we need somebody who's got the enthusiasm to get the thing going, and somebody who can have the contacts and feed into these churches around the world and keep the interest going, so that we have a facilitator who can bridge the gap between ourselves and the people over there. We need the church's support and the leaders of the church and all the rest of it. Yes, that's taken for granted. But it won't work unless there is at least one person or 2 people who are so committed that they're going to give themselves to facilitating the exercise of these things I'm talking about. Secondly, we need objectives. We need focus. We need to know what we're going to do. Not just simply we're going to help XYZ, but we are going to do this specific thing as a project. This is the amount of money we need. This is the amount of equipment we need. This is the number of Bibles we're going to get. This is the number of commentaries or dictionaries or concordances we're going to provide. Set goals and make sure that we get feedback from the people overseas. And incidentally, they're very good at that. They are very accountable. I have no problems with the people in these countries I deal with. They are very accountable and they are very responsive to anything that we send them. And they will give you the feedback so you know exactly where the gear is going. We need to focus and be specific. That's the second point. The third point, we need to pray more than we are praying, and we need to sacrifice our time and money. We need a big exercise in living on less and giving a lot more away. That's not going to happen by itself. It will only happen if you or I make a hard, cold decision to say, I'm going to increase my giving from this to that, and put more and more pressure on ourselves to live on less and give more away. 3/4 of the church live in the non-Western world, and they survive on only 4% of all the resources of the church. The other 96% we gobble up in the West, where we're sick, diminishing, and numbering only about 25% of the total Christian population. The fourth thing I mention here is trust. We need to have trust in these people. Don't give up when we get disappointed. Sure, every now and again something will go wrong. Somebody might misbehave, but that happens in our own churches. That happens in every church that I know of. Sooner or later, something goes wrong somewhere, and somebody has done something they shouldn't have done. But we don't pack up and go home because of that. And we don't write stories about it either and put it in magazines. We normally keep it under our hat so other people don't find out some of the troubles we've been having. We need the same discretion in dealing with people in other countries, and to trust them, to realize that, okay, if something goes wrong, that's not the end of the earth. And that when we give something, we're giving it to somebody else who also is a steward, who ultimately is accountable to God. So that's my fourth point, to trust and not to give up when we're disappointed. And finally, we need the vision to expand and to keep expanding more. We had a case in our church where we got a goal to buy a car for a man in Malawi. We set ourselves 12 months to raise the money. And there was a very good response that I was very thankful for. And now that they'd got into this habit and they'd raised their level of giving to accommodate this vehicle we bought for the man in Malawi, I was all geared up to say, right, now we'll go for the next project. But no, nobody wanted to be interested. They had done their bit. It was a 12-month thing. It was a one-off. They had given the extra, and now they just went back to their standard pattern. And the rest of it I'm going to keep in my own pocket. Thank you very much. We need to be expansive, not just one project, but go from one to another and increase the number of projects, increase the pressure on ourselves, and somehow do what we can to expand the work of God and the word of God, the ministry of God, and help our brothers and sisters in all these countries around the world.